Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly, issuesetc.org. Stay connected, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this night, we will hear the president address both houses of Congress with a report he is required to make, not in person, not necessarily on television, but one that he's required to make every year to the legislature of the State of the Union. These are big speeches, but if you're like me, they don't really stick the way other presidential speeches stick. They tend to be a grab bag of just about everything the president and the country is worried about. Of course, tonight it's going to be probably the economy. It has been and will be for some years to come. Dr. James Berkey joins us to talk about the State of the Union addresses. He's associate professor of history at Concordia University, Wisconsin, author of the forthcoming book, Power, Politics, and the Missouri Synod, and he was a candidate for U.S. House in 2008. Dr. Berkey, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here. Thank you.
This is a report, not so much a speech or a television event, but a report that the president is constitutionally required to make to the legislature once a year. Why did the founders see fit to make this a requirement of the president's service?
Well, there's some question as to why they did, because the article in the Constitution that refers to the State of the Union address is a little bit fuzzy. Article 2 of the Constitution specifies only that the president shall, from time to time, doesn't even specify annually, give to Congress information of the State of the Union, and then to recommend appropriate action. That's about it. There's not an annual requirement here. And in fact, the way it was interpreted over the years has varied from president to president, depending on time, circumstance, and personality. George Washington gave the first really State of the Union address in 1790 in New York City, which was then the capital of the country, and he delivered a speech. But Thomas Jefferson, our third president, ended the practice for a few reasons. He did not like public speaking. He was a very bad public speaker. He also philosophically did not believe that the president should be asserting authority over Congress. He thought that was an interfering of the balance of powers. And then, frankly, he thought that it just looked too much like the king delivering his speech before Parliament, because the State of the Union address does really parallel something that happens in Britain. And so Jefferson, being that strict constructionist, looked at the Constitution and said, well, it doesn't say it has to be a spoken speech. So he sent a written report to Congress. It was read by the clerk, and then that practice continued on for the next 113 years. The president who changed the practice and reverted back to Washington's practice was Woodrow Wilson, and that was because Wilson, unlike Jefferson, wanted to assert presidential power. We're on the verge of World War I, and he was really looking to reestablish presidential authority. Interesting factoid here is that it wasn't called the State of the Union Address until 1947. Before that, whether it was written or spoken, it was only called the Annual Message. And so much of what we see now in the State of the Union Address, the pageantry, even the opposition response, those are not constitutional at all. Those are just products of tradition. The opposition response didn't really come into being until 1966. And that's because Everett Dirksen, the senator from Illinois, who really liked to ham it up for the cameras, wanted to speak for minority Republicans. And he had just come off of a battle over the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in 64 and 65, when his support was necessary to break filibusters by Democrats who were in the majority. And so one of the concessions he drew out of that was this opposition response. And now there's something that's been with us ever since. So again, much of what we see today, the pageantry, the partisanship, the interminable applause that interrupts every three or four words. Those are things that have evolved over time because of personality, politics, even the influence of television.
I was going to ask you about that because an obvious line in history has to be when these addresses by the president began to be broadcast to the entire nation, either via radio or television, and weren't just an address that the legislature heard in their chamber. What do you think has changed in the television era?
Well, television has done quite a bit here. The first televised presidential address was 1947 when Harry Truman gave a live televised address. But they didn't really understand the power of TV at the time. And it wasn't until 1965 the State of the Union address would be typically given midday on television. It didn't have a very big network or a very big audience. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson began the practice of delivering it during prime time. And, of course, shortly afterwards, the opposition had a moment for response. And so the interesting thing is that after 1965, if you look at the length of speeches by words, they've diminished ever since 1965. But the length of the speeches themselves as delivered has expanded because you've had more and more television cameras, more and more manipulation of those cameras. Presidents, this started with Ronald Reagan, but it was became an annual event with President Clinton, and presidents since have continued this practice of, you know, typically having some guests that will be identified to evoke to pull those emotional heartstrings. And we'll see a lot of that tonight. But most of that is due to the presence of those television cameras. One last thing to mention, of course, is that presidents also use this as an opportunity to manipulate the news cycle. And so we see, this morning the president will leak information about little tidbits about what might come out in the speech tonight so it can dominate today's news cycle. The speech itself tonight will have an audience, and then tomorrow the news cycle will again talk about the speech that was given last night. So it's a way of capitalizing on a couple of news cycles. Very interesting.
It's an address that is obviously finally delivered and approved of by the president and his administration. But its construction, I believe, in the case of tonight's address, began well before January. And it begins with all of the departments under the president's care submitting what they think ought to get in there. And then there's this long vetting cycle, and the thing has to be put together as some kind of a coherent speech. Have we watched these speeches simply become a laundry list of policy hopes and dreams for presidents, or is there some coherence, a message to any of these things?
It's interesting. My own sense in watching these things, and I get frustrated every year because every year, like a lot of Americans, I sit down and I hope for the president who will stop that cycle of being interrupted every three or four words with some soundbite. And give us a single message, a short message, a Lincoln-esque kind of message that isn't a laundry list of what I intend to do this coming year. But I've been disappointed every time. And I sense we're going to be disappointed tonight as well, because there are such vested interests, not only lobbyists in Washington funneling their requests through the White House, but people in Congress who want their pet issues addressed. Bureaucracies have worked all year to get this on the agenda. So the speech the president is giving is not certainly not something he's written, but it's something that is the culmination, as you say, of this vast bureaucracy submitting its wish list to the president. I am hoping something different happens tonight. I think we're going to find that this assassination attempt a couple of weeks ago of Arizona Representative Gabby Giffords has introduced here a little bit of bipartisanship and maybe a will to break the mold a little bit. And so one thing I think we'll see tonight, there have been grumblings about this over the past week, is we're going to see Republicans and Democrats sitting outside their typical wings, They're going to sit together because they're friends or because they talk with one another, and so you'll see Republicans on the Democratic side and vice versa. I'll be curious to see how much of that happens, but it might provide an opportunity to maybe break out of that mold of one side standing while the other one sits quietly and vice versa.
Dr. Berkey, before we let you go, you have a book coming out very quickly, Power Politics in the Missouri Synod. In fact, it's coming out next week. Tell us about the book very briefly with less than a minute. And how would you respond to some who claim already that the book is going to be slanted toward the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's take on the battle for the Bible in the Missouri, since it's being published by Fortress Press, the publishing arm of the ELCA? 1 minute.
Okay. Well, it is the story of the rise of the conservative movement in the Missouri Synod, culminating in 1969. But taking this through 1981, and the broad question I try to address in the book is, you know, how is it that our church became so politicized? When did this start? Why did it start? And it clearly started in the decade before Seminex, when conservatives were responding to the introduction of liberal theology and organizing to bring about change in the seminary. So it's an interesting story. It focuses in primarily on two characters, and that's Jack Price, J.A.O. Price, the president of the Missouri Synod until 1981, and Herman Otten, the editor of Christian News. As to the publisher, this is not anyone's take, it's my take.
With only about 30 seconds here.
Okay. I'm a professor at a Concordia University school. I'm a conservative. I ran for Congress in one of the most conservative congressional districts in the country against a conservative congressman who I didn't think was conservative enough. So if that doesn't answer any of those questions, I don't know that anything will. Fortress Press is just simply the publisher I thought best equipped to reach a wide audience of Lutherans and folks in other denominations as well.
Well, Dr. James Berkey, our time is up. Thank you very much for your time. Dr. James Berkey is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin, author of the forthcoming book, Power, Politics, and the Missouri Synod. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. When we come back, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morsch will talk about the March for Life and its connection to defending marriage. Stay tuned.
Here's a great resource for Sunday school teachers. Mondays, we interview Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House about the upcoming Growing in Christ Sunday school lesson. You'll find these interviews under the Listen on Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Listen to a 20-minute interview with Pam Nielsen, and you'll be prepared to teach Sunday school this weekend. Issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand and look for Teaching a Sunday School Lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen.
At SteadfastLutherans.org, we've been called contentious. We've even been called the brothers of John the curmudgeon, and we may well be curmudgeonly sometimes. But we always have the best and clearest voices in confessional Lutheranism. Articles from Molly Hemingway, Martin Nolan, Clement Preuss, Todd Wilkin, and a host of regular contributors. Come check out the new Lutheran media. Always clear, always concise, always confessionally Lutheran. SteadfastLutherans.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. live on most smartphones? Just go to the Listen Live page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the smartphone link, and you can listen on your smartphone weekday afternoons between 3 to 5 Central. Old Theology, New Technology, Issues Etc. now broadcasting live to the world on most smartphones. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.